Welcome to the Rights and Wrongs podcast. This is the second part of the Veterans Day special that I had with Royal Marine Commando veteran Regan Hughes. If you did not listen to the first part, this second part may be confusing, so I do suggest stopping here now and going back to listen to part one. But if you have listened to part one, sit back and I hope you enjoy. This is Rights and Wrongs.
I think people need to travel to other societies and learn what they have, because it is an interesting thing to know as an American from Boston. We're supposed to be one of the most progressive cities in America. But if you dropped us anywhere in the UK, we'd become one of the most conservative cities in the UK.
Oh, yeah, but American politics is very much like that. We sit to the left of your political system and you sit very much to the right. And that's the trouble when people try and compare the two political systems and they talk about them, they're the same thing. People acknowledge that it's very hard for a Democrat to gain the White House in America, because anything that's even slightly left called socialist. Socialism is then just called communism, and that doesn't go well in the United States.
No, the Red Scare is still very much alive, and I always do find it a little interesting that the people that are mostly against socialism in the United States tend to be like law enforcement and military. And it's like, if you think about it, you're part of a socialist system. I don't, when I call 911 or 999 here in the UK, like, I don't get sent a bill at the end of it when they come. That's one of the main reasons I want to do this podcast, because of what we were talking about with buzzwords. That's one thing I try to diffuse, or understanding terminology, because it is a huge thing. A lot of people don't know the difference between socialism and communism, and they think it's the same thing.
It's an economic, that's the thing people forget, that it's an economic theory. Someone a while, not too far in the past, said to me that socialism requires a form of autocracy. That's, you've got an economic theory and a leadership typology, and you're basically conflating them to be the same thing. They are not. Autocracy is a leadership style. Yeah. Socialism, and it operates on a spectrum. You don't have socialism, there you go, is an economic theory. And there's a lot of, it's, people use the word Marxist very often. And Marxism, as far as it, for when it was written, it was clockwork. I mean, it was very, very intricate. It's not survived the test of time. It's not survived internationalization, but at the time, it was like a fine watch. I mean, it was a fantastic piece of writing. It's of its time. It's of a place. It's not survived, but there's elements within that that we have learned from. And if anything, there's an element that's been transported. So we transported something from the national, so the emancipation of the worker, to the international. So we have been at the global north has benefited massively off the labor of the global south. We've effectively exported all the jobs that we don't want to do to places and people that we don't really care about.
The argument between capitalism and socialism. How many wars have been fought over that we now go back into Remembrance Day and talking about a just war? It's such a... So anyone that's listening, it sounds like we're going off random tangents, but these are all intersectionality when it comes to this stuff.
I mean, it's complex. Intersectional to the nth degree, isn't it? I mean, you can't just sit there and turn around and talk about just war theory and then not talk about the idea of economic theory being involved in the Cold War. Was it an economic war or was it an ideological war?
Yeah, and then when you talked about, like, perfectly about, like, Afghanistan trying to push someone up 9 levels of... It's a bad word and I agree with it, but there's no better word in English. Pushing someone that's not enlightened to that level. Same thing happened in Russia. If you look at Russia when they try to implement communism, even Karl Marx wouldn't want, in his books, he said like Russia was not ready for it, just because where they were sociologically. And that's where you deal with a lot of these issues. But we are coming up to the end. I was going to ask, do you have any books or media for a listener to read to like understand these issues?
Off the top of my head, there's a book. It's interesting because I think there's a particular chapter, and we're talking about a meta-narrative. We're talking about before we came online, and I've mentioned it before, how we bask and we view everything through the light of the Second World War, and the idea of just war theory. And again, no one can argue that it's difficult to argue against doing something in the Second World War, not participating, against what we now know to have been a great evil. And I don't like using kind of these binary terms, but there is the way World War II, and very much a part of that, is been kind of touched by the Holocaust. So when we talk about justification, we very much invoke the Holocaust as a reason. We intervene to prevent these atrocities. And then we look at the Second World War, and very often when we talk about why did we go to war, and we think we went in to save people, and to an extent we did. And we often think that it went in to save the Jews and we went to liberate people from the concentration camps. That's just not entirely true. That's been applied post-fact. The meta-narrative that exists around that is big. I mean, it dominates the idea of World War II and every kind of humanitarian intervention ever since. In the post-war era, people were not aware, really, wholesale. of the Holocaust or the Shoah, and only a handful of books were written. Herr Nayer talks about this. I mean, he's a historian, and he mentions that his bookshelf was kind of bare. There wasn't anything written on the Holocaust at the time, and certainly nothing written between 1940 and 1950. And the word Holocaust only really kind of gained traction and awareness after the Eichmannstrahl in 1961. And Stephen Hopgood talks about this in Human Rights End Times. I mean, it's a fantastic book because it very much deals with human rights capitals, so very much big NGO, how it's been utilized and how the Holocaust and the World War II narrative has driven, especially American intervention, well, American-British interventionism. And this is not just global, this is not just political policy, this is social policy. We, political systems are two-way systems. It's not some overarching power dictating, it's a two-way system. We feed into the politics feeds back to us. It's a reflection of us. And this human rights World War II Holocaust narrative has driven our policy for a long time, and it's driven us into a number of interventions where perhaps I believe we should have sought alternative means to rectify a problem as opposed to kind of going for the gun straight away.
No, it's so true when it comes to this stuff, but it's also history is written by the victor, and I think there's a lot of information that's lost about this. I know I talked a little bit about this before, but when it comes to like these holidays we're talking about, started with World War One. This is when these conversations started. America, we're not really taught too much about World War One, partly because of the fact that we're only there for about 11 months. It was just a very quick in and out, and then we're like, yeah, we showed up and the war was over. America for the victory. But we don't talk about the years prior to it, the countries. The war ended more due to economic collapse of the nations more than an actual victor. And we don't talk about that. And that's why we have the reforms that follow afterwards. But when we talk about the Holocaust, and like, oh, it was a just war. But most Americans never talk about the Japanese internment camps in California.
No.
We don't talk about the Tuskegee experiments. We don't talk about all the horrible things that we did. Or yeah, people don't talk about what the British Empire did in India. Like, there's...
This is kind of what gets me. Remembrance is very much about our dead, our war. And it's written when people say, no, it's not. And again, like, granted that it can mean different things to different people. But when you buy an RBL poppy, it is very much commemorating our war dead. And all, and again, they do good work. I'm not saying they don't good work.
Exactly.
A malign entity trying to corrupt us. But when you buy an RBL poppy, you are commemorating our dead, and we very rarely commemorate pain we have inflicted on people. Malaysia emergency, the Mau Mau uprising in Kenya, these were all post-World War II. We talk about fighting for freedom, but very often, and again, people talk about fighting for freedom during World War I. Many people didn't even have political agency. Most of them couldn't vote. Men and women only really kind of started to gain the vote post-1919 with property rights. So again, you've got a class problem occurring there. There's a class cleavage occurring. You can vote, but yeah, you need to have so much property. You need to have so much money. Most of the people who went and died couldn't vote. So whose freedom were they fighting for? Their freedom? They didn't have political agency. Were they fighting for the freedom of the people within the empire that were under the yokes of the great empires, the British Empire, the French Empire, the Austro-Hungarian Empire? They weren't fighting for their freedom, were they? So we talk about freedom as if it's this thing that kind of, it's common to us, it's known to us, it's something that we know about when we didn't have it ourselves. And again, that this is the worst, that it was post-World War II and we were holding on to empire. We were trying to hold on to empire. And what we accused the Germans of, what we accused all the other Axis forces of, we were so willing to implement extreme measures in quelling uprising.
No, it's, there is like a lot of like craziness when you think about that. Like, I'm still learning more about the history, but it is fascinating when like you talk, when you listen to like the history of World War One, it's like the British, like the people of their, this great island fighting. But when you really look at the numbers, more than half the troops were coming from India. They were coming from the colonies in Africa. They were coming from Canada. They were coming from the Commonwealth. And it's just,
this is how it feeds. So again, you mentioned the troops coming from the Commonwealth, from India, from the Caribbean. But this feeds into the meta narrative of the idea of freedom, that we were all in it together, and we had people coming from all over the world to fight again these great evils. But the people coming from these colonial areas, chosen, they were benefiting from empire. The British Empire were good at being good to those who were compliant, who were permissive to our presence, but we're also very good at being bad to those who weren't permissive, who weren't compliant. So again, we create class cleavages, we create ethnic cleavages. So the people who were coming were generally coming over because they were from groups and classes that benefited in some cases from empire being there through money, through wealth, through privilege of being able to touch Empire. Those who didn't want to play ball with Empire, they didn't come over. They were being persecuted back home. And we also are very good at using, because the British Empire knew that it's easier to quell a colony more compliant if you police it with people who are similar. We use their own people against them.
Yeah, that's where the whole entire Hutu and Tutsi thing happened with the Belgian. Like, and it's also just crazy when people talk about these things, where, like, we're trying to stop Germany from taking over countries. But then you look over, if people aren't familiar, look at the history of how America got Hawaii. It is not a very, it's not a history that's taught, but it's a history you need to know, because everyone knows about, like, the Spanish-American War. We went to war with Spanish, we beat them up, and we took all their territories. That's kind of a cut and dry one, but, like, the Hawaiian one, that's just something when we don't even acknowledge it as an American. You need to look at that, and that was right before and after World War II, and going on during World War II, what was happening there. Like, that's a huge thing about remembrance, is we have to remember the good, honor the dead, and I'm with you on that, with, I don't really know the best way to honor. That's a very tricky thing.
I think we can't have a selective memory, and I think much of what we do is selective memory. It's remembering the good parts, it's remembering to an extent myths, but we need to be able to confront our past. And this is that we are very willing to confront the good things, the ideals, parts that make us feel good about ourselves. We'll wear a poppy, we'll wear our grandfather's medals, we'll display them. They're recent, we'll take their accolade. They're not too far in the past. But we use the mists of time argument when it comes to something that we don't really agree with, that's less palatable. So that was a long time ago. That's not my fault. Well, you weren't in the Second World War either, so take the medals off. So again, it's selective memory. You want one, but you don't want the other. And I don't think you can take one without the other. You need to be able to, I'd say, look the dead in the eye.
No, it's true.
That means looking our dead in the eye. That means looking the dead of the countless people that we have wronged in the eye as well.
No, it's an interesting thing that, like, it was a weird, I don't know if the word weird's best, but it was an eye-opening experience when I really started thinking about Hiroshima and Nagasaki. As an American, America is the only country to ever use nuclear weapons on other people. And if you think about it, it was basically five people in that bomber wiped out an entire city off the map. A terrifying thing when, like, other countries, like, wonder why not to go against America. It's like, we will erase cities off your map if you try and mess with us.
I mean, and this is it. Again, there's this common myth as well. I mean, we've grown very complacent. America have gone complacent, almost numb to the relentless bombing of cities. And it's the myth that the war was ended, Japan surrendered because of the two atomic weapons. Now it's heavily disputed. So we've built foreign policy. We have built mutually assured destruction off the back of this myth, when probably the reality was close to the fact that Russia had just launched an invasion with 1.6 million troops. They were landing on Japanese islands. Now, if you're the Japanese, are you going to turn around and surrender to the Soviets? Or are you going to turn around and go, hold on a minute, we're not going to be able to hold out against that. We don't ally against with the other superpower, we're going to lose everything. So who are you going to surrender to? Don't even think the minutes, according to academics, reflected. They didn't even acknowledge that bombs had dropped. They were so concerned about the 1.6 million Russians that were now piling, working their way towards Tokyo. We're about to overrun them completely. The other problem is that, again, the potency of the atomic bomb. It happened. It happened in an instant. There's an impact to it. But it wasn't the biggest bombing.
Dresden wasn't it?
This idea about strategic bombing. So we will bring them to their knees. We will break their morale by bombing. Bomber Harris, it didn't work. Bombing of Dresden, it didn't work. Bomb Germany. The biggest bombing in World War II, biggest casualty, was the bombing of Tokyo, the incendiary bombing. And again, it's indiscriminate bombing. They killed innocent people, men, women, children. And the death toll from Tokyo incendiary bombing was far greater than the two atomic weapons. 125,000 people died in a night.
Well, it's also crazy for my American listeners, people not from the UK or not from Europe. When you talk about bombings, it's this thing as an American, you hear about bombings, oh, those are things that are happening in Europe.
Yes.
But you'll talk to people, like I was talking to people, and like they're from London, and like their grandparents remember playing cards in the subway tunnels as kids as the air raid sirens are going off. And I'm like, that is another thing that I think is like a huge cultural difference between America and the UK or in Europe when it comes to these holidays is, yeah, we had our victory gardens because it's the patriotic thing to do, but we didn't do it for survival in the United States. We had the fear of the Japanese coming over and bombing us, like on the West Coast, but on the East Coast where I'm from, I don't think there was a fear. Like there's fear of U-boats, But that was about the average American doesn't have to have a fear of a U-boat unless you're a fisherman or merchant marine.
That's probably a part of it, again, the change, the feeling, the atmosphere and remembrance here is that at the time people were touched, physically touched, whether they were sent overseas to fight or whether they stayed. Very few people were out of reach of that war. In America, less so. If you went overseas, you were definitely touched by the war. So First World War, Second World War, the war came to Britain. People felt the war. So there is a sense of that. But as we have grown further away from our physical ties, our relations, if we've grown further, they've passed away. We've lost these physical ties. We've also grown detached in the temporal sense. Again, in time, it's become distant. These myths are placing these ideas as we hero worship our ancestors, because no one wants to think of their ancestors bad. And I'm not saying they are bad people, but we glorify the dead in a way that kind of hides the truth and the hurt and the pain that war causes that we experience. And again, that somberness, that weight, that gravity that is definitely in the air on Remembrance Day is there for a reason. And I think we're trying to recreate, we're trying to hold on to that, or we're trying to touch that grief in some way. And we're doing it in a way that is becoming ever more elaborate. And I think that detracts from the sense of grief or real grief. And I'm not saying that people don't feel grief, but the very sense of real grief that kind of weighed on people at the time.
And I think there's this one part, and I see it in America, is, as you said, there's no problem in national pride. Everyone has national pride. And there's no problem in patriotism. But a lot of countries, and especially America, is flirting with that line of patriotism and nationalism.
Yes.
And it's a slippery slope. Like, there's a fence between, but it's not hard to break through the fence. And I think a lot of countries, and they don't understand how dangerous that is. And that's a dangerous direction to go. But when you're dealing with this and you're losing, as you said, we're losing less and less people. Fortunately, I don't know how the best, more people are still dying in wars at the same amount, but less and less people that come back to our communities are being affected by war.
This is the interesting thing. I think the lessons that should be learned, how we should be more cautious, more, a bit more wary about committing our forces. Again, even when Fabian Weir, he was too old at the time. So he had to, I think he was 45 years old when he was trying to join the military, and he headed up the Imperial War Graves Commission. He calculated, and again, this is a random, apparently calculated it'd take the dead 3.5 days to march past the cenotaph, and very much wanted the Imperial War Graves Commission to be a means to drive peace. I now believe that the inverse is true. I believe that what we need in order to live up to the narrative glory of our fallen, we must prove ourselves. And to prove ourselves, it's inevitably going to lead to more violence. Fabian Weir even advocated against the war right up until the outbreak of the war. He was trying to use the War Graves Commission as a tool for building peace. And I think that's kind of, again, it's this paradox. It's not as simple as going, the war graves do this or remembrance does that. And it's one thing. It's more complex. This narrative where I think the inverse is true, where it's become very patriotic, very triumphalist, that it's drowned out the voices of the dead. It's drowned out the voices of people like Fabian Weir.
I think you made a really good analogy before we got on, where the cemeteries and the grave markers of our fallen, they should be a warning of what's to come. It should be the blackboard unless we from where we learn our lessons. But instead, it seems to have turned into an altar that we feel like we must endlessly sacrifice to honor them.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, and we use these words like that, tragedy, disaster. They infer a sense of naturalism, unavoidableness. And I think distancing ourselves from the man-made nature of warfare, and again, sacrifice, it's something we feel compelled that we must do. We must sacrifice ourselves in order to honour the fallen. And I don't think the fallen would turn around and go, tell you what we need is more bloodshed and more gravestones. There is an argument for intervention. I'm not saying that intervention shouldn't happen. I'm just saying we go very much too hip in terms of intervention. Probably become a little bit more wary nowadays. It doesn't sit right with me. And that's why I don't really embrace remembrance and armistice the way I used to, especially when I was in the military. I mean, it was one of my favourite. I preferred it to Christmas. My birthday. Now I'm very much indifferent to it.
It is a very strange thing. I think once I try to use the term re-civilianized. It takes a few years for people to like get yourself back into society. And once you take a good look into yourself, and when I say this, like I think everyone that serves the military needs to take a deep look into yourself and understand who you are now. It's not a bad thing. One thing that I think we're suffering in America from is that people see themselves as a veteran and like that, or a military, and they lose their sense of purpose when they leave. But I'm just asking anyone that's listening to it, and I hope you agree, don't look at yourself as a veteran or a warfighter first, or a soldier or a Marine. You're a human first. I look at myself, I'm a human first, an American second, and I try to put veteran down to fourth or fifth. And it's not that I'm not happy about that. It's just that's not all I am, and I don't want to center all my life around it.
That's something that I've for a long time felt, that I am not defined by being a Marine or by my service. Yeah, I don't even like that word, my service. Honestly, I honestly don't know what it means. Again, people say, oh, thank you for your service. Oh, yeah. What? It doesn't sit easy with me when people start thanking you for my service.
I don't think it sits well with many people.
I don't let it define me. And I think that's one of the things with, and again, I'm talking about veterans.
It's hard to speak for 3 million people.
Yeah. We feel, and again, people have been exposed to trauma, and we feel, or people feel, or may feel that they are owed some dues. You need to pay me respect. You need to pay my friends some respect, my fallen friends some respect. And again, it's this moral hammer that we are wielding above people. I'm not keen on using it. I used to. What do you know? You weren't there, man. That's the kind of narrative that people use. What do you know about Afghanistan? Most of us don't know much about Afghanistan or Iraq at all, or about the people. And a lot of the people who were involved in the campaigns in Iraq and Afghanistan don't know much about the two cultures or the wider story, the wider narrative, the plurality, the complexity of these places. We are very one-sided. And I think we need to look at all the events, take a step back, and very much so in terms of Armistice Day, I think we need to take a step back and look at it and reevaluate the messaging and the stories and make it more open to other people to get in there and not exclude people. People shouldn't feel that they have to march behind or come period of time after the march past, as the White Poppy do it or Veterans for Peace do. And the tokens that the wreaths that they lay should lay there and be valued as much as the Red Poppy. And again, the RBL do not turn around and they do not badmouth the White Poppy. They do not badmouth Veterans for Peace. But people wear these symbols. They become part of the pack. And they act in this, again, the way that they probably wouldn't normally act. And they will remove, they will destroy. And again, hold on a minute. Why is your idea of remembrance more important than their idea of remembrance? Why is their message one of cowardice? And this is the thing. People invoke images of cowardice. People talk about choice. They went marching off. They volunteered. People didn't volunteer. We need to get rid of that myth as well. People, they were drafted. If you didn't go down there and volunteer, you would have been drafted or you would have been hounded. There was social pressure. People didn't volunteer to go and fight for freedom. They were driven off to die for the failure of great power politics. This idea of fighting for freedom, fighting for glory, dying, glorious death in battle, that's a fine thing. If you've ever seen someone die in battle, you're not going to turn around and call it glorious. I mean, that's another outrageous claim. I think use of words like glory, just again, they paper over the cracks because we can't really deal with the trauma as individuals or as a society.
No, you're hitting a lot of great points. When you talk about volunteering and like stuff, like a lot of these things that we're having the same issues in America is their overcorrection, knee-jerk reactions to the way the Vietnam vets were treated in the United States, because they were treated horribly.
Yeah,
I won't say that. And like, I won't say that they weren't. They were treated horribly. And then the new vets, and they came in, it's like, just because, like, but that's a total different game. Most of the people that served in the Vietnam, but most didn't volunteer. They were drafted. Usually was, if you had a college education, you could get out of it. Or like, there was ways the economic classes could go.
Absolutely. And it was disproportionate. The number of people who didn't have, the number of people with no college background and with this economically and socially disenfranchised were Black Americans. And they went and fought for freedom. Whose freedom? Not theirs. And that this is Muhammad Ali. This is one of my favorites. And when he turned around and said, no yellow man ever called me the N-word. And he was hounded out. He was hounded as a coward. People talk about volunteering when there is that amount of social pressure. Hold on a minute. What the hell were they?
Well, like, that's the one thing I find very interesting too. My dad graduated UVM, University of Vermont, in 73, and he was going officer candidate school, like the OCS and like what we call, I can't remember what it is right now, but it's like the one you do while you're in college. I can't believe that I forgot the term, but like, he got medicaled out, but it was more because 73 was towards the end of the war. They're trying not to send people forward, but he lost some instructors to the war. But one of his few African-American friends, because he's in Vermont, there's not many. It's a very white state, land and people. But the thing was interesting, he said one of his few friends that was African-American that did enlist as an officer, well, got commissioned as an officer, he purposely went infantry. And my dad asked him, why did you go infantry? Like, you could choose anything you want. He's like, I know that's the one place I can get promoted. And it's a weird thing to think about, even back in the 70s, when you're talking about, like, you're fighting for a country, but even in that institution, you're fighting to try and help other people, there's racism that you have to fight. It's now you're kind of fighting both sides. You're fighting the guys in the war and you're fighting the people that you're supposed to be fighting with. And that's just a crazy concept to think that most people don't even conceive.
I get, well, World War II as well, African Americans weren't allowed to fraternize with the locals. They were in segregated divisions. Units. They were kept apart because they weren't deemed worth. I mean, they were good enough to spill their blood. I mean, great, cracking, go and die. But don't think you can come over and vote. Don't think you can come and drink from that water fountain or sit there on the bus or sit in that cubicle in a restaurant. But you can go and bleed for us. I mean, it's absurd. It's not, and we all agree. I mean, war is abhorrent. I don't think many people do agree that war is a good thing. But the thing is, the point I keep falling back on, and again, it's the word sacrifice and the way we have to, we feel compelled to live up to the name, the memory of the fallen. Like I said, I don't think the dead have a voice. And what we turn to is the hero worship of the living. And we've forgotten the dead completely. Then again, that might not resonate with some people because there are people who are, there are families who are touched by that grief. But I think for a lot of us, we remember them in name only. Remembrance has become more bombastic, more celebrated. Their glitz and pizzazz must honour it. And again, it's almost pagan, this sacrifice, because now we're anointing the calves before they go off. The amount of money people will wear and display their social participation by spending money on a 70, 75 pound poppy brooch. Why don't pay your respect by voting better? That's different. Or supporting better foreign policy that doesn't lead to the death of children or the death of someone's son, our son, someone else's son, someone's daughters.
No, it is interesting how people, a vote is free. And I want to say financially free for the most part, or should be. Yeah. It's not sacrificially free. Like, people had to basically, in America in this past election, you almost had to give potential of killing yourself by getting COVID to go out and vote, which is crazy because of how states wanted to do things. Fortunately, most states try to avoid that. But no, you do make a good point about, like, when it comes to personal freedoms. One book, if people haven't read it, it's like one of my favorite books when I was a young kid. It's short. It's like 200 pages, called Code Talkers. It's a fictional history of following the Navajo Code Talker, like this one guy. And it talks about how he was forced to go to an American missionary school and, like, he had to give up his dress. He couldn't speak in his Navajo tongue. Like, they would beat them if he didn't speak English. But then World War II comes around and that language saves us for the war. Like, it really did help us. But then he comes back from the war, he didn't get the GI benefits that his white brothers in arms and Marines got. He makes a mention when he gets back to the bar, he gets off the bus and he just walks into a bar thinking, I should be fine. And the first thing, like, he walks in there, they say, oh, we don't serve Indians here. And he goes, well, I don't want an Indian, I want a beer. Like, trying to make a joke. But, like, he comes back to his hometown and, like, he sacrificed for these people in the white town outside the reservation and they just cast him aside. It's a very sad thing we have to pay attention to. And there's a lot, like, what you're talking about with that, like, these organizations, the VFW, I have no problem with. They say the claim that no one does more for vets, and they're right. No one does more for vets compared to, like, other organizations, but you do have to be aware they are a political lobbyist group.
Yep.
You're not going to agree with everything they say. I'm actually very happy to hear there are organizations like Veterans for Peace here in the UK.
Yeah, there's Veterans for Peace and there's the White Poppy as well. They're very much, again, CND, they're interlinked as well. They're not as well organized. They're just much smaller. And the Royal British Legion, again, it's a palatable message, isn't it? You cannot disagree. And again, I don't disagree with remembering the fallen. No one can remember the fallen, but it's the preciseness of it. Remember our fallen. And I know that people will say it can mean anything, and it can. But the RBL very much is a very singular message. But they will change their message at some point to make it more inclusive. I don't think that's going to bring a resolution to it. It's just going to change it. It's just going to ignore it. And the other groups, Veterans for Peace, the White Pop, I think they're going to remain on the fringe. It'll be absorbed. It'll be, oh, we did this all along. And the power of one of the major reasons Remembrance Sunday and Armistice has survived is because it has changed. It is not the same thing. It's not the same thing it was in 1919. It's not the same thing as it was pre-World War II, where it's very much about bringing the dead back, that you look at the paintings, the poetry, look at the media. There's a 1990 a film called J'accuse, and the army of the dead rave. They rise up. Levez-vous, mort de Verdun. Rise the dead of Verdun. Look at this. Cast your eyes upon them. Your sacrifice was in vain. Next day, we go to war. That's the thing. These people have all died, but we're committing the same mistake again and again and again. And we're doing it in a way, I feel, that is to honour the fallen. What do we need to do to honour the fallen? Create more fallen. I think the narrative remembers the dead in a way that propagates the poppies of the future. We're just preparing more people to eventually become a poppy, to become a headstone. And really, what we need to do is go, hold on a minute. We need to think about not propagating poppies. We need to think about not going to war. That means our foreign policy as well. We need to change the way we act economically. We need to change the way our arms industry operates. We may not go to war, but we will sell weapons. We will sell weapons to countries with abhorrent human rights record. They will be utilized. The use of cluster bombs, Yemen, Saudi Arabia. We will sell weapons to people and then go, oh, well, you know, and we'll wash our hands. But we care more about our dead than the dead elsewhere. And again, that's very general. That's not, I'm not saying the whole country thinks that way, because it is contested. There are people out there. And again, there's a split. And no one, that's the thing, no one will disagree with me. Very few, I don't think anyone will disagree with me that we need to be careful about where we sell weapons, who we sell weapons to, what we do.
No, it's true.
Changes need to happen, but we are all political actors, and certain things we do reinforce our policy. We need to take a step back and go, hold on a minute.
Because a lot of the weapons that we gave to Afghanistan, they used on us. Like, that was...
Yeah. Don't know if I've made any points. I've just gone off in crazy stream of consciousness, just tangents with no point and just lost it.
No, I think it's important, though, because these are conversations that need to be had, and you don't hear them a lot of the times. You might hear behind closed doors in certain veteran bars, but you don't hear them out.
No, absolutely. And this is the thing. And this is the complexity of it. It's the duality of man, isn't it? We're not all good. We're not all bad. We paint people as bad quite often because it reinforces our own goodness. But I'm not saying veterans are murderers. No one said that. I mean, veterans are just as much of the victim of our foreign policy as the civilians. It's just a little bit more one-sided. When you start stacking the bodies up, innocent civilians' body count is far higher than ours. This is the absurdity. I said something like looking our dead in the eye. We don't. And part of that is that if we look at the ceremony, the way our dead are brought back, they are saved the dishonor of being viewed. And they come back in a casket, and that casket is draped in the impenetrable shroud of our flag. One, that spares them. Two, it spares their family. There is a point to that. But it saves us. It saves us the embarrassment of looking upon dismembered, mutilated bodies of our children. But we will feast. We will consume the images of the other. We will consume images of wounded children, or we will consume images of the dead Taliban. Whoever the dead Taliban are, this is another. People talk about the Taliban as if they're this one thing. A lot of the Taliban are just farmers in an economic trap. And they're trying to make ends meet. So they go out one day and they get brutalized, but they get painted with the Taliban brush. We consume images of the dead innocents, which it reinforces our goodness. We're over there doing a good thing. But it's just war. It's not that we want to do it, but certain things have to happen. But we don't look our dead in the eye. The metaphor there with the unknown warrior. The unknown warrior is completely nameless. He is shrouded in mystery. He's entombed at Westminster Abbey, and we can't see him, and we can't see our dead.
I think the most important thing is, because we can't look into him and you can't ask him the question, whenever like these things come up, and there's this one song, it was covered by the Boston punk band Dropkick Murphys, but it's a much older song, The Green Fields of France, and there's one line that always gets me, and I never understood it, but the older I get, the more I understand it, is he asks, he's standing by a thing of young Willie McBride, and he's like, during the falling of great 1816, I think it was, but he asked him the question, did you really believe them when they told you the cause? Did you really believe this war would end wars? I'm sorry to tell you, it happened again and again and again and again and again. And it is a scary thing if you get to sit down. And if we did ask those people that fought in these past wars, it's just like these young men died thinking that if I sacrifice myself, using that term, no one else will ever have to do it. But we never learned the lesson that they were trying to teach us.
No, that's the thing. And it's so much easier now because it is so one-sided. We are at distance from our foreign policy. We are not touched in the way that we were, where every family, every village was touched. The Blitz, the bombings of the cities and the dockyards brings the war very much into your own backyard. And war's not very comfortable when it's in your own backyard. We're very much willing to witness catastrophe at arm's length and visit carnage upon people. And this is what they are. We paint them as enemies and as others, but they are people. They are women and even the bad guys are people. whatever their motivations, again, they think what they're doing right. The binary dualism. No side thinks they're wrong. Everyone thinks they're on the side of righteousness, don't they? No one ever sees themselves as the bad. Even the Nazis didn't think they were bad guys.
No, they thought they were saving humanity in their twisted way.
They thought they were doing the world a favor, didn't they? We thought we were doing the world a favor when we was colonizing it. We was bringing civilization. We were bringing light to the dark places. But what we really did is we, for a life part, enslaved people and exploited them economically and physically.
I just want to ask you one last question. You and I both studied international relations, international politics, human rights. What is one thing or two things that you've learned through your studies that you wish you knew as a Marine, and you think that like those serving in the UK or US military should know or should learn beyond what we've already covered?
We don't live in a binary world. And again, I think most people would agree with that. The world's more complex, but when we live by binary rules, good, bad, evil, then we create problems for ourselves. We live in these binary terms. And I don't mean that we don't, that's not an excuse to allow atrocities to occur. We just sit back, oh, well, you know, subjectivity. What I'm saying is that if we see things in binary terms, it limits our options. We need to look at things and explore outside the binary. We need to look outside the binary. We look outside at these, how we construct the world around us. And we need to look for other options as opposed to military intervention. What are we doing right? But more importantly, what are we doing wrong? What have we done wrong? Most businesses, if there is a project in a business, you will write a report. What did we do well? How did this project go? Did you do well? And would you repeat? What did you get wrong? Would you change? We're not doing that last part. We're not looking at what we did wrong. And we're not implementing change. Oh, we are. But we look at it from a very much binary, closed view. I'm caught in this trap where now, knowing what I know now, I wouldn't have joined the military, and I will definitely not endorse or allow my children to join the military ever. I mean, it would take an extreme circumstance to allow me to sacrifice part of my flesh and blood. I wouldn't ask my child to go and hurt someone, nor would I ask them to be hurt in order. That's not going to happen. The other problem is that I am also proud to have been in the military. I'm proud to have been a Marine. There's a contention there. And again, it comes into that kind of that duality of man. It's inside me. It's hard. Would I know what I know now or feel the way I feel if I hadn't been in the Marines, if I hadn't had this experience, if I wasn't able to wield that moral handle of experience that I've accused everyone else of wielding? I think it adds texture and weight to how I feel. I think I've learned a lot. And it places a lot of my life into context, into perspective, I feel. I don't think there's one lesson. I think I've learned more about myself than about the world, really.
I completely agree with you. You hit on a few things that I've hit, like, internet. Like, if I have children, how would I feel about them joining the military, seeing and knowing what I know? And it is an interesting thing because I come from a long line of military. If you're a man in the family, on both sides of my family, you serve in the military. It's kind of not like a questionable thing. But when I enlisted, everyone's like, you know what you're getting into. Like, none of them pushed for it. There was no honor. It wasn't like they were proud that I was joining, but they're like, you know what you're getting yourself into. Keep your eyes open. Learn. And there was always, like, when I deal with my family, there was always with that whole entire pride thing, like, I've always been pulled back, like, be aware. Like, there was always, because of that, they're like, be aware of your surroundings, learn about yourself. And I feel it's fortunate, but also it's kind of a strange thing that you and I, you don't meet many veterans in our fields.
No, and no.
I think we...
I was surprised that there were, yourself was in there, because I forget the Canadian lad's name, and he's ex-service as well, and he's also on the course. I think he was doing international security.
Yeah.
So there are veterans. So again, veterans are great because they ask these questions and they have that wealth of experience. And again, we can wave that moral hammer around.
No, and it's just a question, and it's very funny. I don't want to say funny, but it is interesting though too, is the veterans that are in the course, we also seem to be the biggest critics of the military. Yes. Like, it's a very strange thing. People think, oh, like...
We're disenfranchised and we had a bad experience. We're subversive.
No, because I remember I was sitting, I was taking War Media and Society, and like someone asked, like, oh yeah, I served in the military. And then they started being apologetic when they were talking about critical things in the military. I'm like, don't be apologetic. Like, what you're talking about, I agree with. And like, I even went deeper, and they're like, wow, you're being extremely harsh. And I'm like, you guys only see parts what the media shows you or what the military is willing to show.
That's the paradox that we fall into. No veteran I know is a bad person at heart. Most people, especially in recent years, not so much now, because I think recruitment is very much driven by Afghan and Iraq. And if there are wars not to drive recruitment, there are two of them. The humanist interventionist wars of like Yugoslavia and the atrocities, the ethnic cleansing that occurred there, drove Rwanda drove people like me to join the military. I had a strong sense of natural justice. And you go out there to right the wrongs. And you go out there to put your life on the line. But in doing that, now I've that reflection, I was also willing to commit extremist form of harm to people. You are willing to go out there and hurt other people. And not hurt them, you're willing to kill them. You're willing to deprive people of a son, of a daughter. I'm not saying it again, it's anything, as if people are going out there intentionally killing women and children. But people will make a rational decision. Do we call that fire supporting hellfire? Do we call it, drop it on that compound? Not really know what's going on in there. We blew into a compound. Entry into this compound, I think they used half a barmite to knock into this compound. And there was a man standing there. We blew into his pantry, covered in preserve and dust. His wife and children were in the room next door. They could have died. We would have killed them, but they would have been collateral damage. We don't remember them. They're not remembered on good. Well, we don't have to. Hopefully, they're still alive. But if they were dead, we wouldn't be remembering them on Sunday. We'd be remembering our fallen. That guy was standing there. He was going in there to get some food, to get some jam. He was feet from this explosive method of entry, and he said, and we all burst in the room. The guy was, there was blood coming out of his ears. He was covered in and again, I laughed a bit at the time because he was just didn't have a clue. Covered in dust, covered in jam. But that could have been a very different story. And it could have been a different room that we blew into.
No, and that's the thing too. And it's one thing I always find interesting as well is like you have the education crisis in the United States. And like so many people join the military for free college.
Yeah.
And it's like a strange thing to think about. It's like technically you are a mercenary for education. Because yeah, the wars we're fighting right now, I hate to use that term, but like I was a mercenary for free college.
It's economic and class cleavage, isn't it?
Yeah.
You can get an education. You're not rich enough to get an education. But if you put your life on the line, you can get one. I met people who were, to use the word, stagging on at free border crossing. And they spent fairly cushy 12 months manning a Sanger inside the base, eating Cheetos and hammering the Gatorade and then flying home. But there's a lot of people who are not having that experience and they don't get their education because they're dead.
And that's like one of the strange things to like wander in front of. But I wanted to say thank you so much for being on.
No, absolutely. No, thanks for asking me. It's an echo chamber because we're so fairly similar in terms of the way we are tracking on this. People go, oh, well, that was just a one-sided topic. But I hope that we address the contention that it's not as simple, that we are veteran bashing, that we're not armistice bashing. We're just looking, we need to say, hold on a minute. We need to take a step back.
Well, I think it is an echo chamber, but it's also, we're releasing the echo chamber because I think it's very fascinating when I sit down and I've talked to a lot of people that aren't veterans and like, I'm fine talking about like my grievances with stuff like this. And there's a lot of people that didn't serve in the military and I know some people that have served in the military and they have similar thoughts that you and I have, but yeah. There's a fear of releasing it. And like, it's something we need to talk about. Like you and I are, neither one of us are ashamed of our military service. There's some ashamed of parts of it, but that's more of a governmental level. Like I'm ashamed of being a part of a machine that pushes this, yeah. But not of my personal service.
I'm a veteran and I don't feel comfortable going to an Armistice Day parade.
There is that weird thing of, I want to say survivor's guilt. I think a lot of vets also serve. Like it's a strange thing to like have that, like, why are you thanking me? I survived. Or like, I think, why are you thanking me? I'm a support unit. I'm not front line.
I think a lot of people thank you because they don't know what else to do.
And I don't know what to ever say.
Yeah, I don't know. And again, the problem is that people have been asking for it. And I honestly don't care. Without being dismissive, please don't say thank you to me. I think it's, thank me for what? That's the problem. What are you thanking me for? Oh, our freedoms. You were fine. We're all fine. Sorry. I think sorry is what we should say to people. Not to me. No, don't say sorry to me. Say sorry to the dead on all sides. Ask your politicians to do better. Be more involved in politics. I know people think they're involved.
I think a phrase we need to start pushing is people always say vote. Oh, I always vote for the guy that's best for veterans. I kind of want people to start, personally, like if next time people go for election, vote for the person that's going to less create veterans.
Yeah, vote for the one who's going to provide aftercare, who's going to provide proper physical, medical, and mental health care for the wounded that we have, and vote for the person who is going to be less inclined to create more of them.
That's the thing. It's like, if we stop having, like, we're never going to stop having wars. It's in human nature. But if we have less wars, we have less veterans. And that's something I don't think people understand. It's like, we need to take care of the ones that we have. But can you stop creating more? Like, it's a very... And I'm not saying, like, defund the military, you need it.
The nature of warfare has changed. Pipkin has said, even at a peaceful time. But we don't really, because interstate war has dropped. Civil war has grown. We've got loads of de facto state wars occurring. And how do we mediate? How do we address the economic, the political, the social cleavages which create... And again, a lot of these are down to empire again, because Africa used to be an area of tribal regions, and we've gone boom, 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 nice straight lines. We have incorporated cultures and people into these false geographical regions, and now it's contention. There's race. We create cleavage when we show preference to groups who are more accommodating to colonialism. You have the privileged group and you have the unprivileged group, and these things exist. So we need to find a way of, and I'm not saying there's one simple answer, we need to help manage these cleavages. We need to get technology sharing. We need a better foreign policy. We need a better economic system for a start that doesn't basically leech off of the global south, impoverish racial groups, impoverish entire countries. We just need to be better. My belief is we need to create balance. And to create balance, we need to be willing to give a bit of the power back.
Well,
no system works. Nothing works if there's an imbalance. I do a lot of coaching. A swimmer, if they're unbalanced, is not a good swimmer. A runner, if they're unbalanced, is not a good swimmer. A political system, if it is unbalanced, is not a good political system. There's going to be strain and it's going to break at some point. What we need to do is address the strain. Again, I don't know how that's going to happen. I mean, that's why I studied IR. Can we find a way out? We need to address that imbalance. We need to be more willing to give power over.
Well, it's also
to rebalance on an international scale.
Well, the one thing that kind of gives me hope is I met a girl here in Glasgow who's from Iceland, and she said something that kind of blew my mind, because her sister is a politician. Her older sister is a member of parliament in Iceland.
Yeah.
And it was interesting talking to her, because she's our age.
Yeah.
I am the first person she's ever met that served in a war zone. And like, that's the thing that like kind of blew my mind, like that she knows. So I'm like, 'cause as an American, it's just like, how have you never talked to, with like the connections that your family have, talked to someone that served in a war zone? But then you have to understand Icelandic politics. But it gives me hope there's countries out there that don't have the...
Yeah, that's the thing, that if like, the powerful do what they want and the weak do what they can do, so people do what they do to get by. And there's obviously, again, it comes down to a power imbalance. I funded and got my way through university by working as a coach, triathlon coach, athletic coach, personal training, all those kind of things. But I've got a young lad, 20 years old, and his dream was to join the RAF regiment. I'm like, no, you're not doing that. You're going to go and join the Royal Marine. I think I'm not talking about, no, you don't do that. Don't go and waste your life. I've got, if you want to join the military, go and join. Go do the thing that's better. Don't settle for second or third best. People out there.
I'm glad to hear that the Marine superiority complex is not only an American thing.
But again, a positive life choice in one sense. But again, I'm not going to turn around. That's his choice. I helped him make a good decision. But I'm not going to sit there and say, talk him out of it. Again, like I said, I am not opposed to people being in the military. I myself would be less inclined. I definitely wouldn't send my children to it, and I would instill in them the confidence to turn around and tell my grandchildren and my great-grandchildren not to go and do it.
And that's an important thing. It's like whenever I talk to people and they come in, and I've had boyfriend or girlfriend was thinking about joining, or the little cousin was thinking about joining, I tell them, I'm not going to talk you out of it, but know what you're getting yourself into, know yourself, and it's just go in eyes open and understand that you're joining a community, but don't lose yourself in that community identity.
Yeah, that's the same advice I've given.
But I feel like people just don't realize that. But then again, I wanted to say again, thank you so much for being on.
No, absolutely, no, pleasure. Nice, good to talk about it.
Thank you for listening to this long but very detailed two-part Remembrance Day and Veterans Day special. I hope you enjoyed it. If you did, feel free to listen to other episodes. Also, if you did enjoy this, please consider supporting us. We do have a store where you can buy mugs and hats at rightsandwrongspodcast.com. If you want to challenge something that you heard, or you want to be on the podcast talking about another subject, feel free to contact me at rightsandwrongspodcast@gmail.com. We also have a writing article section on the podcast website, which is Rights and Wrongs Articles. But I hope you enjoyed this episode, and I hope you have a great evening. Thanks for listening to the Rights and Wrongs Podcast.